Ingrid und Indeed präsentieren Jobs, bei denen man sich keinen Fehler erlauben darf. Heute Heizungsmonteurin.
Die Heizung macht seit heute Morgen komische Geräusche.
Entschuldigen Sie, das ist ein geiler Beat.
Die Rohre platzen gleich.
Und jetzt der Drop.
Ingrid!
Das ist ein Job für Premium-Stellenanzeigen. Mit richtigen Profis wäre das nicht passiert. Vertrau Ingrid, versuch Indeed und finde qualifizierte Talente mit Premium-Stellenanzeigen. Mach's dir Indeed einfach. Jetzt auf indeed.de/recruiting.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucksters? What's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How is everybody doing? Today on the show, I talked to Jewel, the Jewel. It's one of those ones that came up. You want to talk to Jewel? I'm like, of course I want to talk to Jewel. What's Jewel been doing? I mean, I don't know if you remember how huge Jewel was, but it was pretty amazing. It was right in the peak of, I think, grunge. And she just comes out of the gate with this basically a folk record. And everybody just fell apart. The entire world. There was a ripple in the musical wavelength. It was kind of amazing. But do you remember that? The album was Pieces of You. It came out when she was only like 21 years old. And it went 12 times platinum. 12 times. That's crazy. And I kind of lose touch with people, but she's, in terms of whether they're on my radar or not, but she's been making music ever since. And now she's opening an art exhibit called The Portal at Crystal Bridges Art Museum in Arkansas. There's also an EP that coincides with the exhibit with new original songs. Busy person. And she's going on tour with Melissa Etheridge in July. She's very excited about the tour because they're going to be sharing a band. You know, you got to be practical when you're on the road. If you can share a band, great. I'll be in Tucson, Arizona at the Rialto Theater on Friday, September 30th. Then I'm in Phoenix at the Orpheum Theater on Saturday, September 21st. Go to WTFpod.com for tickets. There's other dates up there. Wow. So there's a lot of running around. I'm in Seattle right now. But I just got to be honest, you know, whatever's going on with me in Vancouver and whatever I thought that city was, is kind of holding. And I can't say it enough how seemingly relaxed and kind of accepting in some ways the culture is up there in Vancouver and in my experience in Canada in general. And I talk about it on stage. I talked about it at the Vogue Theater when I did the show the other night. And I was heading into that show feeling pretty rusty, feeling like, you know, I've been out of the loop a little bit with the long sets. And for some reason, no matter how long I've done this job, if I don't do it for a couple of weeks or do long ones when I'm out there doing long ones, I don't think I know how to do it anymore. It's a confidence thing, but it's also just, you know, being engaged with that part of myself. Because I'm up in Vancouver, I'm on set, but I'm also just spending a lot of time alone in an environment that is not my environment, a lot of time in my head. And I realize like the difference between whatever's in my head and then whatever happens when I talk to other people and then whatever happens when I talk to audiences is pretty vast. And if I'm alone in my head for long enough, I'll just deconstruct it all the way down and I'll be at like, you know, day one of my comedy career. And it's ridiculous because I got to the Vogue and I did a sound check and I was on stage and I'm like, oh, I know exactly what this is. I know what this is more than almost anything else. I talk to a lot of people, but you never know what's going to happen. And when I get on a stage, it just kind of all kind of comes together. It congeals in my brain. Like, I know exactly what this is. I'm in control of this for the most part, unless something, you know, crazy happens, like a woman faints like last week. But it all came back to me pretty good. And I did like an hour and 40. Charlie Demers opened for me, and it was a great show. It was like a relief to be on stage. And Charlie said something interesting to me after the show. He was very funny, but he was like, you know, it's kind of amazing because of the type of material you're doing that it requires, well, I'm paraphrasing, that it requires a real trust with the audience. And I've gotten to this point with my audience where they understand exactly who I am. So it gives me a lot of freedom to express the things that I want to express in a fairly vulnerable and deep way. I mix it up. You know, there's some fairly edgy stuff in there and some a little bit of dirty stuff, a little bit of sad stuff, a little bit of emotional stuff. Just do what I do. But over the years, I've developed this relationship with an audience. And usually it holds. But I really started to think about that he brought that up. And I realized, like, that's the difference between me just working out in a comedy club, not billed and just doing 15-minute sets in a showcase room with a lot of other comics, and doing what I do for an hour and 40 minutes in front of people that know who I am and come to see me. Obviously, it's going to be different when you have fans or people that want to see you. But why do I do both things? Because I still believe that you got to do those clubs. You know, you got to get up there and kind of wrestle your way through 15 minutes, even if, you know, some of the audience knows you, it's going to be a much different dynamic. The trust isn't going to innately be there. And so my entire tone becomes different. But I got to keep that muscle in play. I got to keep it taut. I got to keep it tight, because I never know in a room full of 1,200 people if one person's going to pop off, and I got to be, you know, ready for that. I can't be up there and get my feelings hurt. So you got to keep those calluses. So like practicing guitar, punching, you know, boxing, whatever the fuck it is. If you do whatever you do and it requires you to engage in a certain way, you better do it as often as possible, or make sure you stay fresh so you don't leave your flank open, man. Right? But I will say this, that the Canadian audiences, or the audience that I had at the Vogue, was just tremendous and just polite, attentive, ready. And it was great. And I was like freaking out for like 3 days before I did it, thinking like, well, what if my confidence fails me? See, that's the thing. It's like, I was talking to Charlie about this. You know, it's not the confidence to do comedy. It's this very fine line when you do what we do, where, you know, the difference between you saying something funny and you just being a guy talking is it's very thin. It's very thin, and it's that confidence that gets fucked with. It's not even a fear thing. It's just that, what if I am too, like, I've spent so much time alone. Yeah, I'm not, you know, I don't have my armor up, or I don't have my guard up, or I'm too much in my head. You know, what if I get up there and I'm just defenseless in a way? I'm just too open. And then what happens? What happens if I do that first joke and it doesn't land? Then, you know, I'm just up there open and feeling like, oh my God, I'm going to disappear. Oh my God, I'm never going to be able to say anything funny if I stay in this zone. That didn't happen. And I don't know that it would happen, but who the fuck knows? It certainly happened in my head. I will tell you that. But again, great audience. And we did a lot of interesting stuff. So now I'm in Seattle. And, you know, the deal with Seattle is that I really used to love this city. I romanticized it. I loved it. And not unlike Vancouver, which is holding. That the whole vibe of not being in the psychic shitstorm and real shitstorm that is America is, at this point in history, is real. And look, I've been coming to Seattle for years. And I got here this time, and maybe it's just where I am. I took a walk for about, you know, 4 blocks to get some veggie food. And it's just rough. It's just beaten. It's dark. It's fucking a little bit crazy. There's an energy here. And it might be just where I am, that it's just, you know, overwhelmingly tragic. And then I started to think about it deeper. And it might be, honestly, you know, just fucking trauma-based, like everything. But seriously, man, my years ago, like, what are the things that I really remember? The moments or things that had an impact on me. I had one of my last drug runs at the Seattle Comedy Festival. It must have been 98 or 99, because I got sober in 99. It was probably 99, early in 99. I don't know. It was maybe one of the first Seattle Comedy Festivals, and I was, you know, up for like 2 or 3 days, and I was in a hotel room with Hedberg, and it was a very kind of I just remember the vibe. I just remember, you know, what was going on. I don't need to go into specifics. I've gone into specifics before about that particular event. I just remember when I was checking out of the hotel, I was sweaty and I threw up in a planter. And then like that was, it was that festival and the Chicago festival that brought me to my knees sobriety wise. And obviously we know what happened to Mitch. So that, you know, that in and of itself as an outstanding memory is dark as fuck. And then my second wife came from Seattle. So I had a very, you know, kind of a real relationship with the city, with her family. And, you know, that was part of the reasons, you know, that I love this city. And that relationship ended up, you know, very badly. And you know, she obviously wants, you know, no communication with me at all. And this is going back, you know, this is already, Jesus, like 15 years, 16 years. But that whole period of my life represents something traumatic. And then, you know, Lynn Shelton was from Seattle. And obviously that has an impact. I think the time before the last time I was here, she was here. So that's a lot of heaviness outside of just the general heaviness of this city that kind of hangs over me and hangs over the city for me and might have some influence on how I'm feeling about it. And I don't eat meat anymore, so I can't even go get my fried scallops. I don't want the people of Seattle to hear me wrong. I know I have a lot of fans here and there's a lot of good people here, but man, the city is heavy. It's heavy for me. And now all of a sudden I'm just sort of like, I don't know, man, the darkness is enveloping me. I got to do my show and get back to Vancouver and breathe. How about a little coffee? Pow! I just shit my pants. Justcoffee.coop. I just had to do that because I slurped. Old school. If you've been with me a while, you know what that is. So look, Jewel, who is from this region, from around here, around the Pacific Northwest, is with me today on the podcast. The Portal is now an exhibition at Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art in Arkansas. You can get the Portal EP wherever you get music and go to jeweljk.com to get dates and tickets for her tour with Melissa Etheridge. This was an amazing conversation. It was a thrill to talk to her. I think she's a very incredible person. So this is me talking to the singular Jewel.
People don't realize how gangster the music business is.
They don't?
Still in a large degree.
You don't think they know?
I don't think they do.
Well, it's just like when you hear stories about it, just how many artists get ripped off, what the percentages are, mm-hmm. how many, like I just talked to Geezer, the bass player for Sabbath.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's nuts.
Yeah.
Like they were with managers and they couldn't, they were living in their cars almost.
Yeah.
They were just getting a stipend.
It's story after story after story.
Of just artists getting
my own. I'm like a cliche
off.
Of the cliche, and I tried hard not to be one.
Yeah, but you can't avoid it?
Well, my story was complicated. But,
well, it sounds very complicated. And all the way through, it sounds relatively complicated.
It really has been. It's been a bit of a shit show, despite my best attempts to not.
Well, I mean, like, I remember when you were globally huge.
Yeah.
Do you?
Yeah. I didn't even do drugs or drink and... So I remember some of it, but I think that sleeplessness and just like straight up trauma like does affect your memory. There's a lot of things I oddly don't remember. I don't remember meeting a lot of people, like huge holes in my whole experience. But yeah, I found, yeah, I don't know.
That's normal though.
Yeah.
I mean, you get to a certain age, you live in enough cities, you meet enough people.
You know,
for me, it's sort of like someone goes, do you remember me? And I'm like, you're going to have to give me a time period.
Context.
And a city.
Yeah. Yeah. Give me a color. What were you wearing?
Oh, really?
I can remember color. Yeah.
Yeah. I still get like, I was surprised like the other, like I couldn't sleep.
Mm.
Pure panic.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of like, I just went back to my earliest worst memories.
Yeah.
And then I just stacked them up. And then by the time I fell asleep, I'm like, I can't do it. I'm a fraud. What am I even thinking? The whole thing's been a lie.
Yeah. What I realized is my worry is a misuse of my creativity. It's like this creative energy I have that gets funneled into like fear porn, like playing the worst case scenarios.
In your mind.
Yeah. And then it's like a river that you can then redirect and go, it's a misuse of my creativity. I have to actively channel this creativity into imagining and creating a different movie in my head, a different narrative in my head.
I have a real hard time with those movies because it's just what your brain does.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have a good imagination,
yeah.
But when left unguided,
yeah.
it's only going to be a horror movie,
yeah.
All the time.
Yeah, I've really had to develop a ton of skills of like sitting, going all of like, I imagine like a river, this river is going this way.
Yeah.
I need to move this river this way, and how do I actively do that, like, in real time? But I had to develop a ton of skills around it.
Really? Just cognitive skills? Like, yeah. Focus? You don't want the river going over the waterfall?
Yeah, it's my river, damn it. It's
like, I have a choice.
Yeah, I have a choice.
There are two rivers.
It's one river, it's two directions it can go.
Exactly. I know the terrain yeah. and both rivers.
Yes.
So you just kind of force yourself?
Force isn't the right word, but, like, I realized at some point that my anxiety... I had like a choice of like my anxiety because I had really bad panic attacks, agoraphobia.
Agoraphobia?
Yeah.
Like panic attacks, like how bad, like you can't breathe kind of thing?
Yeah. So like I moved out of 15 and had never had a panic attack. And all of a sudden this thing started happening to me and I didn't know what it was.
At
I didn't
15.
Even know, yeah, what the word, I didn't learn the word panic attack till I was in my 30s probably. Like
really?
I didn't know what was happening to me. I know. Yeah. It was, I don't know why.
Yeah, yeah.
But it got worse and worse. I got an eating disorder. I guess I was paying rent. I was like hitchhiking to work. I had a dangerous life. I was singing in bars where guys would like push me up against a wall and measure my esophagus and say, have you been cheating on me? Or they'd put a dime in my hand.
What
I
does
remember,
that even fucking mean?
I don't know.
Like guys you were with or just random?
Oh, no, guy? no. Just like, so my parents were musicians.
So wait, let's go back then. Okay, so like I actually lived in Anchorage for 2 years.
No way.
Yeah, my dad was in the Air Force.
What a trip.
So we were there 69 through 71.
Wow.
And all I remember is that there was still a lot of earthquake wreckage around.
Yeah.
Is that possible?
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
But you were like, and I just remember miles and miles of nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Ice floes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, so I have this, like, sense of Alaska.
Yeah.
But I can't imagine, like, in some of the reading I did, because your parents weren't really... They were like, they weren't really hippies. They were literally like homesteader people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was hard for people to understand when I started in the business.
That they weren't hippies?
What that was. Yeah. So my grandparents, my grandfather was part of like the futurist movement, supposedly.
The futurist movement. Was,
yeah.
Was that also an art movement?
It was an art movement.
Because there was a few of them in New Mexico where I grew up.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, and he was apparently going to school in Geneva. They were Swiss, and he was studying the rise and fall of ancient civilizations. And he believed and wrote his paper on the fact that he thought at a certain population index, civilizations fail. And he thought Europe was going to fail. He thought Germany was going to fail, where they all were starting to spend more time.
Let's not call him wrong yet.
Yeah. And so he convinced all these artists and philosophers and painters and just young people to leave Germany and go live somewhere else and to homestead, because in Alaska they were still homesteading and giving you free land if you would move up there and promise not to die for a whole winter.
Right.
And so they sent him ahead as a scout. Everybody learned skills for 2 years, like canning, medicine, herbology, like how to live off the land. And while he was gone, Hitler became a problem, and he came back to get everybody, and nobody could get a visa except my grandmother. And she had been an aspiring opera singer and poetess, and she was with a man named Pegas, and she decided to leave her boyfriend, leave her family, and go marry this man that she really didn't know. In Alaska. So she got off the boat. He handed her flowers. He goes, do you want to get hitched? And she had some money. Her mother had, like, stowed away some money so that she would never have to be dependent on a man. So she felt that money in her pocket, and she said, why not?
Yeah.
And so they walked 250 miles across the Kenai Peninsula
Come on.
The way to Homer,
they
Alaska.
Walked?
Yep. And then
Is that mythology or is that real?
That's real. There were no roads. There was no roads. There was no infrastructure.
So they're hiking.
They're walking.
This, like, you know, kind of middle class woman has, like, hitched herself to this lunatic.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. He had hiked over the Harding Glacial ice field originally to get over to Homer because it was shorter, but it's very dangerous. And so this was the safer way, was just to walk across the wilderness.
From where did she land?
Anchorage. Okay, she worked all the way to the Homer, right, which is like the tip of the Kenai Peninsula.
Right.
So they ended up homesteading. They had 9 kids based on like the Rudolf Steiner, like very philosophical family. He really was a lunatic, a genius.
Yeah.
And crazy. So yeah, like wildly abusive childhood. My dad's childhood was so abusive that when he went to Vietnam, it was the first time he ever relaxed.
That's crazy.
That's gnarly.
Like abusive how?
Lots of types. It was a really, like, they were stuck on a homestead with no roads, no way out, horse and wagon.
9 kids.
To town, 8 kids.
8 kids.
Yeah, so 10 people living in, like, a 2-room cabin, 8 kids sharing 1 bedroom, and no groceries, no anything.
Like, animals?
Oh, yeah. Big animals, cattle, horses, lots
Whole
of hunting.
Farm. Yeah.
You know, hunting vegetable gardens and bear, anything like that. And so it was a great childhood. My grandmother, like, taught them how to sculpt and paint and draw and poetry. My grandfather was brilliant, like an incredible linguist and very philosophical. So they had a really interesting, beautiful childhood. But it was also very physically abusive, very psychologically abusive and emotionally abusive.
Just because of the expectations to work?
No, I just think my grandfather had a
beat the shit out of people.
Yeah, yeah, he was brilliant and dark, and it was, and you're stuck on this little place. And my dad actually has a really incredible book called "The Son of a Midnight Land," and just about overcoming abuse. And then when my mom left when I was 8, I'm fast forwarding. My parents sang in hotels. Then when my mom left when I was 8, my dad and I became a duet, and we started singing in bars, and that's where.
You know,
they were
develop.
rough places. That's where, like, the men started, like...
Sure. How long was your dad in Vietnam?
He was part of the 69 Tet Offense. He was part of some gnarly stuff. He was really, really in it. Yeah, and he got a medal, and it's a sacrilegious thing for me not to know the name of the medal, but he was one of the few, like, he was a cook in the Army, and he got a medal because he was so able to lift the morale of his fellow soldiers.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, but he started writing songs then.
But he didn't come back strung out or anything?
He came out with a lot of PTSD, and then married his high school sweetheart, who was Mormon, and tried to just be a good family man.
Did he become Mormon?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Are you Mormon?
I was raised Mormon.
Oh my God, this keeps getting worse. Lunatic homesteaders with philosophical ideals,
yep,
and then Mormonism.
Oh, wait till you hear about my mom. It's going to get really good.
She was born Mormon?
She was born into the, her family was Mormon from way back.
Like old school,
yeah,
many wives kind of deal?
I don't think there was any polygamy in the branch of my family, although I've never studied and gone back very far, but my grandmother and grandfather were not.
You never did 23andMe without, you know, genetically what you are?
I need to do that.
It sounds like you got a lot of, what is it? Is it Swedish?
I have some Swiss in, I'm definitely Swiss.
Swiss.
Yeah. Whatever, how I get my squinty eyes and the cheekbones, we're not sure yet.
Yeah. You don't know.
I don't know. Something was in the woodshed somewhere.
You've got to get on that show with Henry Gates.
What is that one?
The Finding Your Roots show.
Oh, I know. I do.
I'm going to tell him.
That. Yeah, let's do that. I want to understand.
I'll email him because they have whole teams of people.
Yeah.
And you got such an interesting story. I bet you he'd love it.
It'd be so fun.
I'm going to email him.
Yeah.
We're not pals,
I would
but
love to
I
do
did
that.
The show.
I
but
would
you
love
seem
that.
Like it'd be good.
It'd be really fun. Yeah.
Wow.
So then, like, he definitely came out with more trauma than when my mom just left suddenly. He took over raising us, but he started now what we would call trauma triggering. And to self-medicate, he started drinking. That went rather predictably.
So he had the trauma from his dad, and then he got the trauma from Vietnam.
Yeah.
And then now it's time to pass it on.
Now it's time to share.
Yeah. Share the
share
trauma.
Share the patterns. Share trauma. And he did a lot better than his dad did. Like, when I hear stories of their childhood, I'm like, I cannot believe my dad did as good a job as he did.
Yeah.
But he started to be physically abusive when I was 8. So it was like suddenly, like, went from this Mormon, like, family home evening.
Were you in Utah?
Like a nice, no, Alaska.
All the time.
Yeah. And so, I was born in Utah, though. My dad, for the GI Bill, got to have a college education, and he went to the university in
Brigham
Utah.
Young?
Brigham Young.
Huh.
And so then we went back up after he graduated.
To the original homestead?
No, to Anchorage.
A
we
new
lived
one.
In Anchorage.
Oh, so not a farm?
Not yet. No, this was just like...
Oh, there's farms coming?
The farm is coming. Yeah. I was raised in Anchorage, sweet Mormon family, singing in hotels for tourists. Cruise ships would come off.
The whole family?
I would yodel. The whole family sang. There was like a 60 millimeter show on my homesteading grandparents and my dad's childhood.
Oh, that's right. Was it a TV show?
Well, back then, my grandfather actually has the filmed homesteading. It's kind of the only film existing of homesteading in Alaska. It's actually very cool footage.
Is it called something?
I don't think it's ever really been released. It's just kind of in the family. Yeah, it's around. It's around.
There's a couple of canisters of film around?
Yeah, I've made sure it got transferred so it could be, preserved.
Okay, so that's done.
It's done. Okay. I did my job.
All right, good.
Yeah. And so my dad and I became a duet when my mom left. And so he became, he started smoking cigarettes, dating women, being physically abusive, and drinking.
And all this stuff.
It was hard, right?
Why'd your mom split? Was that a drama business?
You know, it was interesting. I don't really know. You know, at the time she said my dad blackmailed her to keep us, which looking back doesn't make a ton of sense because my dad actually didn't really, he wanted us. He did it. He did the job, which we could have gone to foster care. I'm glad he did it.
Yeah.
But you could tell it wasn't easy for him. It wasn't like, yay, this is what's happening in my life.
People get a little, I think they get threatened, like they want to hold on to something. And a lot of times it's kids.
That wasn't actually what went on with my dad. No? My dad did it because my mom split. I think she got tired of being a mom. She wanted to have a different experience, but she sold it as propaganda in a way that made her look like the hero and my dad the bad guy.
Yeah.
And so now you're starting to see this narrative of my dad being pitted as the bad guy, which he yelled and he hit me. And so it was a really easy sell.
Yeah.
And my mom was this calm, creative, spiritual person who, poor her, wasn't allowed to keep us because my dad blackmailed us. And so it started to be this wild narrative where I would then hitchhike 250 miles to Anchorage to spend time with my mom. I'd show up on her doorstep unannounced. And then she would start.
When you were how old?
10-ish, probably.
You're hitchhiking by yourself at 10? Mm-hmm.
There was something in Alaska called the ride line. A lot of people didn't have phones, and so the radio was how people communicated. And so I would put an ad out on the ride line saying, looking for a ride to Anchorage, we'll split gas. So it wasn't quite hitchhiking. It was just hooking up with a stranger that was going to Anchorage.
But it always has creepy connotations, you're going to get in the car with creeps.
Oh, my God, I could tell you stories. Yeah.
What?
Yeah, crazy. Oh, my God. I'll have to tell you that one story. If you want that story, I could tell you that story.
Yeah, go ahead.
But to continue that little narrative, I would show up and then not realizing she didn't really want to see me, she would be like, I'm so glad you're here. You know, your mind is so powerful. I was like, really? She goes, yeah. All of us only use 10% of our brain. And I was like, really?
Yeah.
She goes, yeah. I mean, imagine if we could use more of our brain, what would be possible? I was like, yeah. And she was like, I bet. I have heard that if we stare at light bulbs long enough, we can learn to make them dim. I was like, really? She goes, yeah. She goes, I think you're capable of it. I want you to sit and stare at that light bulb. I'm going to be gone for a few hours, but just sit and stare at that. That's how she babysat me.
That's like abuse.
It was abuse. But I didn't know it because she was so kind and she believed me. I sat there and stared at light bulbs. And I would think it was my fault because I couldn't get them to go out or dim.
She didn't punish you if you couldn't, did she?
No, she would just subtly be like, maybe you just weren't focusing hard enough. Like it was your fault.
That's crazy.
So that was, this weird dichotomy that started happening with my mom. To go to the story of getting to Anchorage with the bad ride. In Homer, we were grocery shopping. This gentleman approached me at about that age, and he said, maybe I was 8, 9, and he said, you're really a beautiful young girl. And I'm like, thanks.
Yeah.
And he goes, I'd love to take your picture. I'm like, I'm good. And then I went and found my dad, and he says to my dad, your daughter's beautiful. Maybe we should do some headshots. I had an instant awful vibe about him.
Yeah.
My dad was so flattered. He's like, we'd love some headshots. That'd be great.
Yeah.
And so we go to his trailer where he pulls down this weird little backdrop for high school photos. And he has me posing. The photos are very funny. I think they're in my autobiography where I'm like, I look pissed the whole time.
Yeah.
He just creeped me out. So we left and I told my dad, I can never be around that human again. I can't be around him. He's like, Jewel, you're being so unfair. He's so kind. He's doing us a favor. So I put a ride line out, right? I'm trying to get to Anchorage. Say my name. That's the guy that offers me a ride. And so I have this choice. I really want to go see my mom. I'm homesick for my mom. I take the ride.
Yeah.
And I'm so viscerally frightened the whole time. I have no reason.
He's not
being weird. 5-hour drive.
Wow.
We get to a rest stop in the middle of nowhere. I literally wouldn't go in the restroom until I saw another woman go in.
Yeah.
I had my hand on the door handle, like ready to throw myself out. I'm like, something's wrong with this.
Yeah.
So on the way back, he was like, when are you returning? And I was like, he was literally going to wait for whenever I was going to go back to Homer. And so I was like, I'm fine. I'll find another ride. There's something called a fisherman ride line.
Yeah.
Where like when the fishermen get off the boats, it's like this van that stops in every single city and drops all these fishermen off. It's stinky. It's gross. These men haven't bathed in a long time. But that's what I ended up taking back to Homer just to
feel more comfortable with
safer.
The stinky fishermen.
So fast forward maybe 6 months, a year, my dad sits me down. He goes, Drew, I have to talk to you. I sit down on my bed. He has this news article and he had been a child pornographer. And had been molesting children. And he cried. He's like, I will always trust your judgment from now on. But that bar singing and those experiences gave me such a good radar for creeps, which ended up helping me in the industry
a
lot.
Had a good radar at 8.
I had to have a good radar.
So you just refined it as you got older.
Yeah.
So your dad got a farm, though?
So we ended up, when my parents got divorced, we moved back to the homestead where my dad was raised. And so that—
Was your grandfather still alive?
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was still alive. We moved into the saddle barn. It got converted into like a living space. My dad had a room and then my brothers and I shared a room. And it was a coal stove, running water, hunting and gardening for food, just surviving and living off the land. I really liked that. I loved that lifestyle.
Who did the hunting?
All of us.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What were you hunting?
All of us. It'd be anything depending on the season.
And you just
from
grill
grouse
it up?
To, oh gosh, you'd can salmon, you'd freeze meat, process it, you'd do the whole nine yards.
So this is a skill set you have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you use it?
Not now, but it's a great skill set. I mean, pioneers are the original entrepreneurs. Like they find a way. You have to find a way forward. And I wasn't raised in a culture where women had certain jobs and men had certain jobs.
Yeah.
There was no distinction. I was expected to get things done no matter what the problem was. And that ended up being one of the best things for me as I left home. You know, even at such a young age, I was always like, I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
If somebody tried to leverage me, I was like, no. I'll figure it out. I can live on nothing. I can live nowhere. Like, and that ended up being a superpower.
But it's interesting, like, as an adult who's been in the world of music and business, that there wasn't a point where you would, put together some line of homesteading products or teach people how to can or pickle or hunt even.
I actually thought of an app called Urban Homesteading where you could barter because people have surpluses. Like people that love crocheting have way too much knitted things.
Yeah.
And people who have a tomato garden have too many tomatoes. And so if people could barter and swap, I actually just think it'd be a really nice, sustainable thing. But
what happened with that idea?
Yeah, I didn't know how to get that.
Now someone's
going to
do it.
Well, good. I hope somebody does. My family got discovered, like, without anybody knowing they were me, related to me, because there's just such an interest in Alaska. And I remember my little brother texting me one day. He's like, I'm about to sign a TV contract. And he doesn't own a TV. And so I thought he was, like, in an electronics store. I was like, you don't have to sign a contract to buy a television.
Yeah.
And he goes, no, a reality TV contract. I was like, what are you talking about? I was like, don't sign it. Don't sign it.
Yeah.
Would you send it to me? He's like, I don't know where the document is. I'm like, who wants you to sign this? He's like, I don't know, a producer. I'm like, what producer? And he goes, I don't know. I'm like, for what company? He goes, I'm not sure. Maybe something with Discovery. I'm like, Discovery Network?
Yeah.
I go, make somebody call me. Nobody calls me. So I have CAA cold call Discovery and go, if you're working with a Kilcher family, we represent them. Discovery calls whoever the producers were. The producers call my dad and are like, the Discovery apparently was like, how do a bunch of hillbillies in Alaska have CAA calling us within 6 hours? So the producers call my dad and they're like, are you guys represented? And he's like, oh, my daughter's the singer Jewel. So they had no idea.
Oh, my God.
But the show was successful, like 12 seasons.
What?
And that caused the super interest in homesteading and living off the land.
When was that?
And canning. It ran until like just 2 years ago. It ran for 12 years.
So your whole family's kind of, you know, making a nice living off of.
Yeah.
That's kind of nice.
Yeah, off of, it was really helpful. Yeah, it was helpful for them. I became like this de facto middleman.
Like a manager?
Yeah. Not really a manager, but just trying to help between the two worlds.
So that much of your family is still living that life?
I'm the only one outside. We call it outside. The lower 48. The funniest call I ever had was Discovery called me. They're like, Jewel, we're sorry to bother you. We're having a problem. Maybe you could help us with it. I'm like, sure. What is it? They're like, we need to pay your family, but they want us to show up with a suitcase full of gold. And they're like, we're trying to explain to them, like, we have to pay them with a check.
Yeah.
We'll fly up with the check.
Yeah.
But we can't pay them with a suitcase full of gold or cash. And so I had to call my family. I'm like, you're going to be paying something called taxes.
Yeah.
And it's happening. It is upon you now.
Welcome. Welcome. Welcome to the future.
Welcome. I know.
And they figured it out?
Yes.
Did they have bank accounts and whatnot?
They all worked it out.
And you still have a good relationship with these people?
Yeah. Yeah. It's been interesting. My family's really dynamic. They're great storytellers, all creative, all write songs, all write poems, all sculpt, all paint. Like, they're just an immensely talented.
I wonder if that came down through your grandmother, I guess, huh?
It did. Yeah. Wild. Yeah. And it's so prevalent. Like,
it's just the nature of who they are. They're creative people.
It is. Yeah. And at an incredibly high level. Like, they're beautiful creators and storytellers.
Yeah.
My dad got sober in his 60s. I didn't think we'd ever have a relationship. When I left home at 15, I was just done. I had a lot of healing to do. I knew that statistically kids like me end up repeating the cycle. I knew that statistically, I knew that it was dangerous. I knew it was very dangerous to move out on my own. You don't go from the kettle into the fire and think that movie is going to end
right,
well.
Sure.
And so my job for me became, how do I not become a statistic? And I remember just learning in science class about a genetic inheritance, that I could have a genetic predisposition to diabetes or heart disease. And I realized I had an emotional inheritance. And I'm very visual, and so I saw this image in my head of like this, I don't know how to describe the image, but I saw this image of like kind of like a family tree maybe, but it was emotional. And I realized, like, my grandfather, the way pain and punishment and anger and conflict and all these things got resolved, addiction, rage, eating disorders in my family, I was like, I have inherited an emotional language, and my job, I think, is to learn a new emotional language. But where do you go to school for that? You can go to school to learn Spanish, but you can't go to school to learn a new emotional language.
It seems like, you know, that seems kind of ahead of its time and thinking, and like you were sort of aware of that clearly when you left?
Or is it
like sort of like now you kind of see what you were doing instinctively?
No, I was very cognizant of that.
Of like trying to do it differently.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't know why. I was always very observant, like singing in the bars. You know, my dad had just become abusive. We just got divorced. I was in pain. When I started singing in bars every night, I saw alcoholics, I saw drug addicts, I saw prostitutes, and I have always seen patterns, and when I would reduce that to the simplest common denominator, the common denominator was pain.
Yeah.
We were all in pain.
Right.
And nobody knew what to do with pain.
Well,
and
that's like, do you ever read that guy, Gabor Mate? Like, he's...
Oh, yeah, I talked with him. Mm-hmm.
Like, that's his thing, man.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, he's been kind of like building a new paradigm for therapy that's based on trauma.
Yeah. For me, I realized, and I remember writing in my journal, nobody outruns pain. Nobody. I literally watched people drink themselves to death, not have the money for a coffin, and we would do fundraisers in the parking lots of bars for these people. And again, I'm visual, so I saw it as like this original pain. And then you layer all these, now what you would call medicators. I just saw it as layers of earth. All these ways of avoiding pain. And then you still had this original pain to deal with. And if you had some kind of ability to go archaeologically through all these layers, you still had to deal with the original pain. And so my note to myself was like, the quickest way is through. And I had read that the buffalo is the only animal to go into the heart of the storm. And I was like, I need to be the buffalo. I have to move toward my pain and not away from it. Like, that became my survival strategy. So I made a promise to never drink, never do drugs, and try to get closer to pain.
And that was that what the writing was at that time?
Yeah. So writing made me see patterns I never noticed before. It helped me understand things. Yeah, it just brought something else out in me. There was an observer in me I didn't realize was there observing. And so it gave me a stronger... I did read a lot of philosophy at the time. So I remember reading like Descartes and I Think, Therefore I Am. And I was like, wait, it's I perceive what I think, therefore I am. I'm the perceiver.
Right.
And so if your body was a car, you're not... The brain isn't the driver. It's the steering wheel. Me observing my thoughts is the driver. The observer is the driver. And
sure.
I realized I had to create a much stronger relationship with the observer if I was going to change my life.
Yeah, I seem to frame it as that at some point, wherever the most pain occurred, you kind of have a possibility of staying there emotionally.
Mm-hmm. You get frozen.
Right. So then you have this, you know, this kid in this adult body who you have to figure out how to get up to speed.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be like a lifetime's work.
Mm-hmm. It can.
So, okay. So now you have all this awareness and you're writing these songs. But
I didn't start writing yet. I had the awareness that I had a big challenge, that I didn't know how to make a new emotional vocabulary, but that maybe I could get a new vocabulary by studying other people, looking for words I liked, basically, emotional interactions,
and then seeing
if I could adopt them. It wasn't music yet. It was just me watching people, watching interactions, watching dads pick up their kids from school. And did they touch? Did they not touch?
Sure.
How did people handle conflict and people just learning an emotional lexicon, as it were. And I did pretty good. Like, I stayed off the stripper pole. I graduated school. I did okay.
Where'd you go to school?
I ended up getting a scholarship to an amazing fine arts academy called Interlochen in Michigan.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, my town helped me do a fundraiser to help me earn.
Homer did?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, these six women took me under their wing and helped me. Like, it was my first solo show. I did all cover songs because...
Post-dad?
I had moved out at this point, yeah.
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 But you were still in Alaska.
Yeah. I was paying rent in a little cabin, I think like $400 a month in a little one room
But the town
cabin.
Came together because they know your family.
They know my family, but really it was these like six women that took an interest in me and were like, you can do this. Like, I got a $5,000 scholarship. I had to raise 10 and they were like, you can do it. I was like, there's no way. I have a month. And they're like, what can you do? I'm like, I can sing. They're like, could you do a solo show? I was like, I've never done one.
Yeah.
Could you get one together? I'm like, yeah. So I learned a bunch of Cole Porter songs because there is a gay man in me dying to get out.
Yeah.
And the whole town rallied. They taught me how to go to businesses, how to get, you know, items donated, how to auction them off in the intermission. Like, whole playbook. It was magical. And they helped me get the money to go to school. I show up to school with like a large hunting knife, a skinning knife, because every kid in like, you have to have a large skinning knife in Alaska. I hitchhiked from Detroit up to Traverse City. You need a knife.
Oh, is that where it was? It was in Traverse City?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a little like art scene there.
Uh-huh. Yeah, Interlochen's just outside of Traverse City.
So you're, what, 16?
Yeah, 16 now. Show up, almost get kicked out the first day. They're like, I get called to the dean's office. Yeah. And I was like, what happened? I just literally walked down the main street of the campus, and he's like, where are you from? And I was like, Alaska? He's like, give me the knife. This poor dean. Like, I was the only kid on my own. I didn't know you had to pay for, like, books and food so I had to get a job all of a sudden on campus just to figure out how to, like— I thought I was going to have a butler for $15,000 a year scholarship. Sure. I didn't know what to pay for food. It was shocking.
Was it hard to let go of the knife?
I didn't enjoy that, but it was fine.
Was
you
it
know?
A special knife?
No, it's just
Your knife.
Grew up with a knife. Like, it just, how do you eat an apple? I don't know. Like, you're like biting into this big round thing, but like, it's stupid. Like, why wouldn't you be cutting it up?
Where's your knife?
I know.
Couldn't understand the other kids. Like, no one's got a knife.
But on spring break, I couldn't stay on campus because I couldn't afford to go to Alaska. You weren't allowed to stay in your dorm. Yeah. That was a pickle for me. And so I started hitchhiking across the country, hitchhiking through Mexico. That's when I started writing songs. And they gave me my knife back for that.
They did? The dean said, like, all right, summer, here's your knife?
It wasn't summer. It was like winter break and spring break. So all the kids go home to their families.
And they're like, can't let her not have her knife.
And I'm alone being like, well, my big plan is I'm going to hitchhike across the states through Mexico. And he was like, you can have your knife.
That's a long trip.
It was.
Detroit to Mexico?
Yeah.
And that's when you start writing? So you got your guitar with you?
Yeah, I had a guitar. My dad sent me down a guitar. And then I just had that in a backpack and I hopped trains. I couldn't learn other people's songs because I didn't know how to. I learned like four chords in a specific order, like A minor, C, G, D. I couldn't go out of order because I just didn't have the dexterity yet.
Yeah.
And I couldn't learn other people's songs. And so I just, my dad had improvised a lot as a kid.
So you were primarily just singing with your dad?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. I just did harmony, maybe lead on two songs, but I really wasn't doing my own thing at all. But because I had to earn money on the way, I was like, I'll street sing. I'll make up lyrics about people as they walk by. I'll improvise and see if I can earn my way. And that's
on
when
that
I started
trip?
Writing. Yeah. Yeah. That it was, you know, I think my first stop was going from Detroit to Chicago. And I said, where are the people? And they said, Michigan Avenue. And so I walked there and I would make up lyrics. And it was my first time seeing, like, being around pop culture.
Yeah.
You know, I was raised so far outside of
You're
pop
like
culture.
A hill person.
I was a hill person. And so the lyrics I started writing were like people living their lives for you on TV. They say they're better than you and you agree. And it was just the stream of consciousness about sure. what I was seeing. And that became Who'll Save Your Soul. And that was the first song I wrote on that trip.
Really?
Yeah.
The first song you wrote on the trip becomes like the hugest hit in the world. It's crazy.
It was crazy.
But so when do you refine it? How long were you in school for?
I was in school studying marble carving and visual art.
Marble carving.
Yeah. And like clay studies and, you know, like traditional casting, sculpture. And then...
Like bronze casting?
Mm-hmm.
Like with the
learning
molds?
Learning patina and all that. Yeah. Not originally. Like I came there as a vocal major, even though I had to suddenly start studying classical music. And my job on campus was modeling for the class. But I asked so many questions. The teacher was like, you need to be in the class. So she let me join. And so I got to double major and then I double minored. And the dean tried to kick me out for that. He was like, you can't do all these things. You have to focus. You can't, you know.
And you're like, you took my knife. Now you want to take my dream.
I know. I was like, this might be the only year of my life I get to have access to this kind of education.
Yeah.
And I was like, you can't let me not do it. And he goes like, you're skipping lunch to do this. I'm like, I need to learn. I don't need lunch. I'll eat lunch while I'm doing this other class.
Yeah.
So he ended up letting me do it.
And then you were there for the full time?
I was there for 2 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, junior and senior year.
Okay.
Then had nowhere to go. My mom was sick in San Diego, so I went there to take care of her. Working
what
was the
multiple.
Matter with her? She had heart disease.
Oh. She's still around?
It's a good story, that one. That one's a good story.
It's a bad story?
It's not a great story, you know? Yeah, it's not an awesome story.
What are the bullet points?
The bullet points are what I thought was happening was my mom had heart disease and she couldn't work and I was taking care of her and I was working multiple jobs. A boss propositioned me, and when I wouldn't have sex with him, he fired me, wouldn't give me my paycheck. I couldn't pay my rent. My mom and I both got kicked out. We both start living in our cars. My mom ends up going home. I'm homeless for a year.
To Alaska?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh.
I ended up, the homeless story is a whole story of that year of my life, which was really transformative.
In San Diego.
Yeah.
At least it was nice out.
It was a great place.
To be homeless?
Oh, my gosh. It was better than, like, the barn I was raised in with my... Yes, it was not bad. My car got stolen, which sucked, so that was a pretty rough moment. And I had bad kidneys, and my panic attacks got worse. That's where my agoraphobia really kicked up. And then I just started shoplifting, and there was a moment where I looked in the mirror of a dressing room where I was shoving this dress down my pants, and I was like, I am a statistic.
Yeah.
I didn't beat the odds.
You did.
I'm going to end up in jail or dead if I don't figure something out.
Oh, no.
And so I came up with a whole new set of, for some reason, I had a weird talent for writing and for what now you would call behavioral tools. Like, I knew behavior drove life, and I started creating behavioral health tools for myself.
Just a survival instinct.
Yeah, and to try and to not be in jail. Like,
right.
I knew stealing was the first thing that was going to land me in real problems.
Right.
And so that was the very first thing I focused on.
Stealing.
I focused on that, yeah, which was a whole process.
Yeah, you like to steal.
I loved it. Yeah. It checked a lot of boxes for me. It helped me eat. It distracted me from my anxiety.
It was exciting. Yeah,
that's actually what I learned is that more than a shoplifting problem, I had an intensity addiction problem.
Oh,
like I realized during that time, your body only has two basic states of being, dilated and contracted.
Yeah.
Every single thought, feeling, and action leads you into one of those two states.
Sure.
So I started to make a list of when every time I was dilated, what was I thinking, feeling, doing? Every time I was contracted, what was I thinking, feeling, doing? And by the end of it...
When you were contracted, were you just thinking about being dilated?
No. Like, did that throw me into, like, a panic?
Well, no, just sort of like, because I imagine, like, dilated means, like, just jammed on cortisol, right? Just kind of like the excitement.
Opposite.
The opposite.
Dilation means you're in your parasympathetic nervous system. It means you're relaxed.
Oh, so dilated's a good one.
It's a good one.
So when you're dilated, you kind of want to be contracted.
No. So these two states actually work in harmony every day if we're regulating well, right? Focusing takes contraction.
Okay.
Even your eye to focus takes it contracting and the muscle contracting.
Right.
For me to study for long periods of time, I have to focus. I have to get into contracted.
Right.
So there's healthy states of contraction.
Right.
There's unhealthy states of contraction like anxiety, panic attacks. It's just being dysregulated
right.
is like the modern way of saying it.
So it's not like I'm like, you know, I'm excited or I've got all this dopamine going or I'm bored.
Excitatory is actually a contracted state. Uh-huh. And so you're actually talking about neurochemicals and you're talking about your sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system.
Two different things?
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So your parasympathetic is your calming. You're not in fight or flight.
Right.
Your contracted state is your sympathetic nervous system where you are in fight or flight.
Yeah, that's the exciting one.
That's the exciting one.
Yeah.
And so like a huge problem today with our culture, one of them is that we're confusing excitement for happiness.
Right. Well, you know, you got a thing that you can look at every day. Like you just like you can spend like hours just being emotionally jerked around by your phone.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all contraction.
And it's pharmacologica. Like mm-hmm. what I realized is even though I never drank and did drugs, I got myself addicted to my own biochemicals.
Right. Well, that's
excitatory chemicals.
Well, that's what stealing does.
And
right?
so I You're could get a hit.
Jacked up. Yeah.
I was a junkie to my own contracted state. And so what I realized basically is like, follow me through my childhood. I'm an abusive, it's an abusive, intense, frightening environment where I'm always on my toes and I always have a contracted state, hypervigilant. I become performative to get love. Like I'm a good singer. I get good grades. I get the pat on the head. That makes me feel good. I have to keep doing more of that to keep getting that feeling. I can outstudy people. I can take more pain than people. I have more endurance than other people. I get more pats on the head. Well, now I don't know how to relax. I'm really good at staying in this contracted, hypervigilant state.
But at least the singing and the proactive stuff was okay. Good.
Oh, you get very rewarded for it. And right. it was good.
Singing's better than stealing.
Yes. But where it starts to get bad is I didn't know how to relax. So people like me with my, you know, I like to have my body in fight or flight. It's where I'm the most comfortable. That means you're always going to kind of look for a drama, maybe. You're going to be attracted to high intensity things. People like me would like shoplifting or sex addictions or drugs that are like cocaine or uppers or those types of things. But I don't know how to relax. And so falling asleep is hard. That's where people like me start to want to go to like dilating medications. Because what do all drugs do? They either contract you or dilate you, period.
I know. I'm like strung
There's
out on
nicotine.
There's
uppers or
right
downers.
Now.
Like that's how it is. And so when I work with kids or I work with people, one of the big things I ask is just like, which drugs do you need? Because it just helps me understand which nervous system they're stuck in. So you can help develop behavioral tools to help them without chemicals, get themselves into a different state organically.
So this being an active therapeutic practitioner of sorts is your whole other life.
Mm-hmm.
And when you started to do the songs and get the feedback, I mean, I imagine that all that contraction was necessary to live through and succeed those first few years.
What I learned when I was homeless was that I was addicted to excitatory states, that every time I dilated, I had feelings that I was trying to avoid.
The sadness.
Mm-hmm. And that, because with excitatory things, right, like self-harming, if you have a baseline of anxiety that's so high, a brilliant way of your psychology handling it, one of the ways you can handle it is do something louder. It's like if your faucet's running and it's annoying, turn the radio on louder.
It's almost like a Ritalin thing.
Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Like if you're hyper, get more hyper and you'll kind of level off.
I guess so. Yeah. I don't know a ton about that to be able to.
I'm just trying to make
to know. But it's
analogy,
just like if something's really painful as a baseline, do something louder than that. So self-harming makes you so aware of physical pain that it helps you ignore
your
anxiety. Not really. Mm-mm. No, but shoplifting's the same thing.
Sure.
Like it's all just different ways of
doing
the same thing. You wanted to do something so distracting that it distracted you from the anxiety you were having.
Yeah.
Whereas when you soften and dilate, and that's what taught me it, was I was trying to learn to stop shoplifting. So I thought I'll replace the behavior.
Yeah.
I like writing instead of stealing. Every time I steal, I'll write. I hated writing at that moment. That got me really curious. Why do I hate writing when I love writing? Why do I not like writing right then? And that's what caused me to discover this thing of writing actually is calming. It makes me soften.
Oh, so
it makes me open. It makes me have feelings. Those are feelings I've been trying to avoid.
Yeah.
So I actually had to like find a new level of going toward the pain. And so by the time I
But initially it's just not satisfying.
No, because I was wanting a hit.
Right.
I was like a junkie. I just wanted my hit.
Yeah.
I didn't want to like have feelings and calm down and like face it. So I had to train myself to do that. And to let that different type of biochemical that gets released be rewarding. I had to learn to get addicted to a different type of drug.
Yeah, but I mean, after, but this is like, I mean, in this period of time, you know, after whenever these revelations happened, I mean, I guess the initial one happened so you could be comfortable with writing and know that you were processing things through it.
It was just so I could stop stealing, and I was a prolific thief, so I became a prolific writer.
But I mean, at some point when you're opening for Dylan and you're, you know, whatever, however long it takes for that first album to blow up, I mean, you've got to be pretty contracted.
What I learned when I was homeless was that I figured out that I could be happy with nothing and I could find freedom and liberty in my own body. Right. I found liberty. I found how to help my stealing. My panic attacks nearly went away. My agoraphobia. Now, I still had vestiges and I still had things to work. So that when I got discovered, homeless kid, bidding war, offered $1 million signing bonus. And I almost didn't sign the deal because I knew, again, just like somehow I knew when I moved out of 15, that this movie doesn't end well. Kids like me with my emotional baggage, now what you would call trauma, with that much money, and God forbid I get famous, it's every bad movie you've ever seen on every biopic on every musician.
Sure, but it's a good run.
I almost turned it down. It scared me. Like, I felt like what I had discovered when I was homeless was so valuable that that was the most valuable thing. I found something valuable.
But you were getting validated for the work. I mean, like, you were playing out and you were doing these shows and people loved you. And
what I got validated for was my favorite writers were Bukowski and Anais Nin because they told the truth. They didn't use art as propaganda.
Yeah.
I realized I was very lonely and I deserved to be lonely because I wasn't authentic about who I really was. And so I decided when I started to write these songs, I sang for two people at my first coffee shop.
Yeah.
I sang 5 hours of the most gut-wrenching, honest, just tell the truth on myself. It was a huge risk because I always hid. I always tried to make myself seem more perfect than I was.
Yeah.
And so I just made this commitment to be honest. And these two surfer boys that came probably just because I handed out a flyer and they thought I was hot came in and they cried. We all cried. I cried while I sang. They cried while they listened. We hugged afterwards. And what I got validated for was being authentic. And that was really rewarding. But it wasn't because I was getting rewarded for
those
two surfers that became four, that became 12, that became 20. But it was about authenticity. And so I almost turned that record contract down because I didn't think I could handle it. I didn't think I'd built the internal structure to withstand
that
fame.
Being authentic.
I know I could be authentic. I didn't know if I could handle the pressures of the career and the pressures of fame because I'd seen so many other people fail. And so for me, it was, again, like, how do I make a strategy? And
what
so I
you
made myself.
When you think you because you weren't working with people that failed, but like in your mind.
Oh, there was a lot of biopics out and there was a lot of autobiographies
of musicians.
Right,
sure.
Yeah, that all became drug addicts. And I just knew I was a candidate for that.
Yeah.
And a lot of us die young. A lot of musicians die in their 20s. Like, it's not a kind business to people.
Yeah.
And I was watching Nirvana and we just lost Nirvana. Like, you can only be miserable so long until you succumb or you find a way forward. And I just wanted to find a way forward more than I wanted a record deal. So I made myself a promise that my number one job was to learn how to be happy. Was it a learnable skill? Was it a teachable skill?
Yeah.
My number two job was to be a musician. And under that, I wanted to be an artist more than famous. So that gave me like a hierarchical way of making decisions.
Yeah.
And then I was very loyal to it. And so that was from everything from like I went to the library and got a book on the music business. I learned how contract works. I learned, because like nobody gives you $1 million. That's not free.
Yeah.
So why? How does it work? What's the price I'm paying nobody's telling me about? And so I realize it's in advance. I realize I have to recoup it.
Yeah.
I am able to start doing the math on the amount of pennies per album I'm going to be trying to recoup not only the $1 million advance, but $1 million worth and probably trying to help break my career. I was able to do the math on how many albums that mean I need to sell, and I realized that was impossible. Like, that'd be almost impossible. So I was leveraging a product that didn't exist and putting so much pressure on it that I could probably be dropped from a label before I ever had a chance to have a career.
Right.
So I turned down the bonus. I took the biggest back end anybody had ever been given. I just asked for them to pay my rent, moved my mom and my brother in with me. And then I set about trying to figure out how to be an artist more than famous.
Yeah.
So that meant making authentic music. It meant making a folk music at the height of grunge, which I knew wouldn't be a popular move. And trying to, like, I turned down what was that show, Big Brother? It was like the first reality show, like,
was
back in the day.
Was it on MTV or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they were like, Jewel, you're going to be on a reality TV show where you're going to go from living in your car to moving into this house where you're going to be filmed with these roommates will watch you make the album. By the time you release your album, you're already going to be famous. And I said no. And I remember they were just like, why would you say no? And I was like, because hardwood grows slowly. And they're like, come again? And I was like, there's no shortcuts. I want to be something that grows slowly and lasts a long time, not something that grows quickly and falls over. I wanted a career. And so I just tried to be very loyal to that hierarchical decision.
Did that make it slower process?
Much slower. It almost failed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that album took 2 years to break. I was laughed out of every radio station. I was talking to DJs that are like, how do you give a blowjob with teeth like that? That's literally your live air. And you're like, what? And I was like, you know, funny thing. I can fix my teeth. How are you going to fix being stupid? I would get escorted out of the stations. They would kick me out of radio stations. I remember having a guy being like, hey, you may have heard me describe my next guest as a large-breasted woman from Alaska, Jewel. How are you? And I was like, you must be that small-penised man I've heard so much about from South Carolina. Click, off air, escorted out of the radio station.
Really?
My label was like, will you please? And I was like, no, I fought too hard in my life. Like, I grew up these bars where I learned to be like, no.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to put up with it. I don't need to be famous that bad. I need to be myself
that bad.
That's
pretty punk rock, huh?
It was very punk rock. I was kicked out of more stations than any punk rock band, for sure.
Well, those guys are the worst. Like, because they have these egos that are disproportionate to really their fame because it's regional, but they're huge.
They also didn't have the intelligence Howard did. Everybody was trying to be Howard Stern.
Oh, at that time.
But Howard, you know, and he did invent being a shock jock, but Howard was very, very bright. A lot of these people were just trying to imitate.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you mixed it up with him, I never did a show back then, but like, he was there. He was listening.
Sure.
You know, where these other guys were just trying to be shocked.
Yeah, he'll be nice and conversational, and then he'll throw in the dirty question.
Yeah, and then he'll see what you do.
Yeah, exactly.
You don't got to go for it. Like.
Exactly. But yeah, just to open with that stuff, and you're a nobody and nowhere.
Well, yeah, and also when they're just not smart. And what do I say?
No,
I don't mean to sound so...
Yeah.
But just, they can't take a joke back.
That's right. That's
all
still
good.
A problem.
Go ahead and take a jab.
Yeah.
I get to take a jab back. But if I don't get to take a jab back, then what are we doing?
Yeah. Yeah, because we're not talking about music. You're just trying to, you know, corner me or minimize me or diminish me.
Yeah, which is fine. I want to do it for you, too.
Yeah,
let's both do that. I like doing that. It's fun. I want to be entertained, too.
Sure. So you kept doing that. And then how did ultimately it get through? What do you think did it?
The first one, album failed. We finally decided it was just time to move on. We tried to save your
from
soul.
From Pieces of You?
Yeah. We tried to Save Your Soul. It didn't work. We tried You're Meant For Me. It didn't work. We tried to recut You're Meant For Me. It didn't work. Finally, I went off the road. I was doing over 1,000 shows a year. I was doing 6 shows a day. I was opening for the Ramones. I was opening for Catherine Wheel, Belly, getting shit thrown at me. Like
for the Ramones?
Yeah. I got the whole audience to actually storm over the barricades and like come up to the front from the lawn. It was like, and I remember like Joey and them were like, that was punk rock. Like, thank you. I was by myself. I never had a band.
You were just
me
you
alone
and a guitar
on my stage. Yeah.
With the Ramones fans?
Yeah, with Bauhaus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Well, they must have been a little more polite, I would think.
They, you know, I had to pay them. This isn't the day where, like, nobody would take me out. So I paid bands $500 a show to, like, take me out because nobody would let me open for them. Like, nobody. It was brutal. And I was in a rental car trying to keep up with tour buses and doing like 8 a.m. shows at high schools at 9, 2 radio shows, 2 record shows, opening up for like Bauhaus and then doing a midnight coffee shop show.
It's lucky you didn't have a band.
Yeah.
It was easy.
It was easy.
To go with the guitar.
Yeah, I could go anywhere.
And did you find at those times, like what was your percentage rate of actually getting them to shut up and listen?
Pretty high because, you know, like being raised in bar singing, get heckled a lot.
Sure.
And so, and we never did set lists. And so I learned to handle live audiences and to be witty and to be quick on my feet.
Yeah.
To sometimes have to sacrifice somebody that wasn't listening. I'd ask people, like, I do all the tricks, right? Holding really long notes, making up lyrics about somebody right in front of me. Like, a lot of tricks to try and get people to engage.
Entertainer tricks. Yeah.
Yeah. Of, like, doing my job.
Yeah.
Like, my job is to be captivating and to get your attention. I'm not entitled to it. I know you're not here to see me. But when all that failed and somebody's just talking, I'd say, hey, I'm right here. I hear you talking about your sweater.
Sure.
And if that didn't work, I'd stop and I'd say, I would like to invite everybody that doesn't want to see me here to leave and go out in the lobby.
Yeah.
If there's two of you left, I want two of you here. And so I would stop the whole show and do that.
And they must have been like, what is happening?
What is happening? But I usually was able to get...
Most of them?
Yeah, most of them. Well, and I was able to convert.
What's interesting about being... you know, a solo act like that with just a guitar is like, it could really either go, it could go either way. The intimacy can happen and really, you know, catalyze.
Yeah.
Or else they could just ignore you.
It was a lot of storytelling. It was a lot of stand-up, on all honesty.
Sure.
Like, you have to be very on your feet, witty, funny, finding ways of getting them. So I liked that. It's fun for me. It's creative and really, it's a dynamic, dangerous thing to do, which keeps me really interested.
Yeah.
But anyway, the first album failed.
Yeah.
I started recording a second album, and then Bob Dylan asked me to open for him. So I put the album on hold.
What was that phone call like? Hey, Jewel.
I didn't get it from him. It was like manager to manager. But I was stoked. And so I went out on just a short stint, like 2-week East Coast stint. And his manager was like, you're not going
to
meet Bob Dylan.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
He's not going to watch your show. I just want to let you know. I was like, I get it. I'm here to do my job. No problem. So I go out there. People aren't listening. We're playing theaters. I do all my things. I try to get people to listen. Nobody will listen.
That crowd?
That crowd.
The oldies?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so I would single somebody out, and I'd say, I hear you. Will you please leave? And if they refused to leave, I would shine a spotlight on them.
Yeah.
And I would single them out. I'd ask them to leave. I'd say, I understand you're not here to see me. I understand you all love Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
I love Bob Dylan. But I am up here and I hear you and I am a human being and this is awful. So please leave. And so I would kick people out of his shows. I'd single them out. I'd make them go. After about the fourth night, his manager came up to me. He's like, you're not going to believe this, but Dylan's been catching your shows. And what it turns out he loved is that I was kicking people out of his shows. Like, Dylan's like, I fucking love that girl. And so he started mentoring me. Every night he'd bring me down. He'd go over my lyrics. He'd be like, what made you write that?
Yeah.
Is that a Merle Haggard reference?
Yeah.
And like, that's a reference in Whole Save Your Soul nobody's ever gotten but Bob Dylan. And of course he would get it. And he's like, what are you reading right now? And I was like, I'm reading Proust. And he goes, oh, yeah, I learned French once to read him. I'm like, of course you did. You're Bob Dylan that learned French to read Marcel.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
But he gave me like books to read and music to listen to, and he believed in me.
Yeah.
And he was like, you just have to keep going. He was like, are you a singer-songwriter or are you not? Like, do you think like this is going to make you popular? Because singer-songwriters don't typically get real popular, so you have a choice to make. And I was like, I'm a singer-songwriter, sir.
I will
keep doing my job, sir. And he's like, just keep being solo acoustic. Just keep doing it. And then Neil Young took me out. And kind of the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, we were playing The Garden. I was solo acoustic. He had Crazy Horse with him. And I must have looked green one day. I was walking through the, like, a common space where he ran into me. He goes, what's the matter? I was like, he goes, you look nervous.
Yeah.
I was like, I am. He goes, why are you nervous? And I was like, because you're Neil Young with Crazy Horse and this is Madison Square Garden. I'm like, they're going to murder me out there. And he stuck his shaky little finger in my face. And he was like, this is just another hash house on the road to success. You get out there and you show them no respect. And again, I was like, yes, sir. No respect, sir.
How did that work?
I actually did something I'd never done before, which was like, I wasn't allowed out on a... you know, a keyhole stage. They kind of have that like long strip that goes out into the audience. I wasn't allowed out there. But I went over like the little barrier and I walked out there and the spotlight couldn't find me, which was very effective because suddenly nobody knows what's happening. They see a spotlight searching and nobody knows like what's happening, that something's unorganized.
Right.
That gets people's attention. The spotlight finally found me. I'd carried my little mic stand out there. It was feeding back. That got people's attention. And it's very loud. Everybody's talking, and I start playing some harmonics. I detune my guitar into an open D. I start playing these harmonics, and I sing this lullaby called Angel Standing By. All falsetto, no vibrato. I whisper it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the whole audience is going, shh, shh. What is she saying? Shh. And I got the whole garden to be quiet. Like, you could hear a pin drop. It was amazing.
Wow.
It was pretty cool.
Yeah, and then you were able to keep them there for the whole set?
Yeah.
Did Neil see it?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know.
But that must have felt great.
I was proud. Yeah.
So then all of a sudden the record starts to get traction.
The album starts, to get traction. And by the time it started getting traction, I was selling a million albums every single month for over a year.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it was bonkers.
And how'd you handle that?
It was exciting because I worked really hard.
Yeah.
I really wasn't built for fame. Like, I wasn't built to have that much attention.
Yeah.
I'm deeply empathetic, and I also just had a lot of trauma. I didn't know the word, you know, at the time, but like, people would grab you and they'd touch you. You can't do that to me. I wasn't, I had too much trauma. So it'd be like fisticuffs. Like, I was a scrappy, you know, men would like grab me and turn me around. It'd be like, it wouldn't go well, you know, but the internet was just starting. And so I was able to like go on these listservs and be like, you guys can't touch me. You can't even get within like 5 feet. Like, I'll have a panic attack. And so my fans just started rallying around me. And to this day, when I see a fan, and like, they're a fan, they get about this close. They put a hand out for, like, a safety gesture. They're, like, open palm. They're like, hey, I just want you to know. But it, like, creates a lot of safety. And I really appreciate it. But what I realized, like, and then my second album, luckily, did really good.
Yeah.
And then I had to quit. I was like, I hate being this famous. I am not built for it. I'm not built to have bodyguards and not be able to grocery shop or cross the street. People follow you in the bathroom and like they're like, I'm hearing Jewel pee. And you're like, what is happening?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I realized that I could control the pace of my career. I realized like I could tank my momentum, tank my fame. I could become less famous. I could switch genres, which was very hard career-wise, but interesting to me creatively. Yeah. And that would also make it, I just lowered my fame. I didn't like it.
On purpose.
On purpose.
And that's when, like, you were just experimenting with different producers, I imagine? Or, like, what? Like, because by the time you get to 03, 04, that's, like, a totally different sound.
Yeah. Yeah, what I realized I liked, like, I took 2 years after my second album, after Hands.
Yeah.
And I realized I liked being less famous. Yeah. I realized I did love music, but I like learning more than anything. And so I knew I would experiment with genres. I was raised in all genres, listening to all genres, and that's what I wanted to do with my life.
Yeah.
And so I knew that would be hard. I knew I would have to start over every time because the way radio testing works, just in the business, it's boring. But familiarity ratings help you get played. And I never had familiarity ratings because Standing Still didn't sound like Hands, didn't sound like you were meant for me.
Yeah.
So I always was like fighting an uphill battle, but that was okay. I don't mind working.
But you were selling enough records to make a living?
I had that, back to that first contract. I had the biggest back end anybody had ever been awarded. And
which
so
means?
I made a lot of money.
Right.
I made a crazy amount of money. And for every million albums I sold, we made it where I got another half a point of royalty. And I sold over 12 million albums.
Right.
Like, it was silly. I
so
had a
you
very,
were able
very
to kind
good.
Of stash that and be.
Yeah, I was
feel
like,
safe.
If I don't spend my money, I get to do whatever I want creatively. I never have to have a hit again. Like, I never.
And that's
I don't
been
have to.
All the way through to this day?
Well. What had happened was my mom reentered the picture. Mm. Back to the mom storyline. It's complicated, but when you said, like, what happened during that period of my life, my mom had heart disease.
Yeah.
Turns out, I don't think she did.
Yeah.
Turns out, I think she even had some money, but was letting me pay the rent while she was maybe not actually even sick.
Yeah.
And when she went back to Alaska, when I got discovered, I called her. I was like, Mom, you wouldn't believe it. Like, getting signed by a record label. And she's like, I'm going to come back to help you. Thanks, Mom. I felt
really?
Like, oh, my God, my mom loves me. It was bad. She, like, would advise me, and then she became a co-manager and then a manager. And then she was like, you know, this business manager is stealing from you. Not much. Five grand. But enough. And I was like, and she just knew how to get me. I was like, F him.
Yeah.
We need to manage my own money. Yeah. She's like, we should manage your own money. So flash forward, I'm making a pop record. Biggest risk of my life.
Which
creatively,
one?
03, 04. Yeah. I knew people, like in the 90s, credibility was everything. It's hard for a girl to be credible. And you don't get to be a credible girl and then go make pop music. It was not allowed. I knew I would piss people off, but I wanted to do it.
Yeah.
And during that time, I realized all my money was gone, that I was actually $3 million in debt, and that my mom wasn't who I thought she was at all.
Oh, my God.
It was awful.
And so you had to, like, start from scratch?
I had to start from a hole.
Pay a $3 million hole?
Yeah.
After 03,
and so I had this, like, decision of, like, I'm about to make a radical music departure that's going to get me unliked.
Yeah.
Do I go with it? Do I stay with it? Do I go make a safer record? And I was like, it's what I want to do. It's what I feel called to do, so I'm going to do it.
Yeah.
And thank heavens it became a top five pop single, and it helped dig me out of the hole. But I was going to go on a huge tour, and I got with Irving Azoff, became my manager, and I called him, and I go, I don't think I can tour. And he goes, are you okay? And I was like, I'm not. Like, I'm going to have a psychological breakdown. I was like, but I'm going to be okay. And he goes, okay. And that would have been the first time Irving would have made money with me. He helped me figure out, like, how to, like, figure out the shit show that was my financials of what happened. And I just took 2 years, maybe more, to heal. And I didn't want to work with a therapist because I didn't trust. My mom had been so psychologically and spiritually abusive.
Right.
I didn't want anybody in my head.
Yeah.
And so it caused me, kind of like that time when I was homeless, to develop a whole new system and set of tools to help me distinguish, like, what are my thoughts versus somebody else's thoughts? What are thoughts I've confused for my own?
Uh-huh.
And who am I independent of that? That was a radical time.
Wow. But you were able to kind of wrangle it together?
Yeah.
With Irving, did he eventually kind of guide you into the right direction?
Oh, he was always amazing, like on the music side and on the business side. But for me, what I had to figure out was the psychological side. Like, I had to quit. That was back to that promise of, like, I have to, happiness first, music second.
Uh-huh.
So I needed the money, but I didn't do the tour. I took a huge hit. Like, you can't just skip a big tour, you know what I mean, and pick up where you left off. You pay prices for these things. But it was a price I was willing to pay because I didn't want to have a mental breakdown.
Right.
And I had to figure out, I had been brainwashed. I basically was in a cult. Like, what had happened with my mom? I have this book. You have to read the book to really understand. It took 350 pages to explain, like, the arc of the psychology of what happened. But being able to see that, you know, a soul isn't a teacup. It can't break. Like, I exist in here.
Yeah.
There's an allegory of the golden statue. Have you ever heard that? It's like an allegory of a warring tribe is coming. There's a valuable golden statue. The villagers cover the statue in mud so that the statue won't be stolen. War comes and goes. The town is ravaged. They forget the value of the statue. One day, heavy rainstorm, a child's at the foot of the statue sees a little glimpse of gold. They realize this thing they've walked by every day is solid gold and very valuable. For some reason, I remembered that story one day looking in the mirror during this time of my life. And I was like, I exist in here.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think I'm broken. You can't break what's inside. I just have to do a very loving archaeological dig back to what I am. I was just covered in layers of trauma, basically. And so how do you do that archaeological dig? And again, those started to become tools that I was able to help other people with and became a second career. Like, it's weird.
Would you start a foundation?
Yeah, 22 years ago, started a foundation because I felt like misery is an equal opportunist.
Yeah.
But if you want to learn how not to be miserable, it takes education.
Yeah.
And education costs money.
Yeah.
And so happiness can become elitist. It's unacceptable to me that people without resources, kids like me who moved out and didn't have a safety net, we can't get therapy. You can't afford therapy. You don't have these places to go. And so there's no safety net. And just when you do the numbers right now, we're 500,000 therapists short in America. If everybody were to seek care that needed it, we'd be 5 million therapists short. We're not solving this bottleneck in a traditional way. So, 22 years ago, I wanted to see if without therapy, I'm not against therapy. I love therapy.
Yeah.
It's just not accessible and affordable to everybody. And so could we create a system that worked with complex trauma, PTSD, suicidal ideation, self-harming, disordered eating? And now we have one of the highest success rates in the world, actually.
What's the name of the foundation?
Inspiring Children.
Wow.
Based out of Vegas.
And that's your child?
Yeah. My co-founder and I, Ryan Wolfington.
Wow. That's impressive. Like, that list, I've got two or three on that list.
Yeah. Yeah. I've had all of them.
I don't, like, I, and I'm 60, and it's just, you know, it's starting coming to head now, some of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you got to figure out how to do it.
Yeah.
But
that means, like, there's a sign of health. I really do think, like, if you found some equilibrium and now it's all of a sudden things are coming up, that's a sign of health. Like, often that'll scare people of, like, wait, I've done all this work. Why am I getting worse?
Yeah.
It's usually because, like, you've such a, it's a sign of health. Your psychology, your psyche knows it's safe enough to bring up a new layer.
Right.
For you to handle. So I really see that as a sign of health.
Right. Unfortunately, it's happening right when I want to relax.
Yeah, that's unfortunate.
But all in all, and you did a little acting, but do you not love it?
I loved it. Yeah, my first role was with Ang Lee.
Yeah,
I find it much more psychologically interesting. Like, in songwriting, you can't really get into, like, much deep psyche, where acting is all about, it's never what about you're saying.
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
But when I looked at starting to go on auditions and do a multiple career, I just went back to that. Is this going to lead to a happy outcome? I looked at people with multiple careers and I was like, doesn't often work out, but they are very famous. And yeah. So I have this thing called my deathbed decisions where I like lay on my deathbed. I pretend I'm on my deathbed and I look back at this moment in my life and I go, well, I have cared that I'm an actor or will I have cared about something else? And I was like, something else.
Wow.
I found it like very creatively fulfilling. But the casting calls, the roles I was getting was like the Halle Berry part in Swordfish where you have to show your tits when you bring the book down.
Yeah.
Or like, it just wasn't great parts. Sure. I was super lucky with the Ang Lee film because that was an amazing female role. And I just didn't like, Hollywood was rough.
Sure. And you already done the music business. So, you know. Well, but what's interesting though, despite whatever you think about celebrity, is that your, I don't want to say brand, but Jewel in and of herself has remained, you know, everyone knows who you are.
Mm.
And like you, you know, and clearly you have plenty of fans who must have grown up with you at this point.
Mm-hmm.
You must go and do shows and people have been with you since they were kids,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of interesting.
Yeah.
I imagine they're the ones that put their hand up for the boundaries.
Yep.
Because they know you enough.
Yeah.
So you're kind of who you are precedes you. In a very, you know, culturally relevant way. You're not, like, whatever you did to get out of anything or take a break or whatever, everybody knows who Jewel is. Occasionally, some people go, maybe say, like, what's she up to?
Yeah.
And then they'll go look. I'm like, oh, she's done 9 records, you know, and then they got to get into it.
Yeah. And then it was also just building other things. When I was 40, I realized I couldn't just tour as a single mom. And so I built a mental health company, and we built a mental health platform that is in VR, and it's a scalable, affordable way for people to get help virtually. It's at inner.world.
Inner.world.
Yeah, and it's free for a certain amount of access and then $8 a month, which is not, I mean, and we're a clinical research platform, so we're tracking outcomes and we've been able to write 2 white papers showing we're as effective as traditional therapy, but it's based around CBT and DBT skills in group and anonymous settings.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing. It's the first real radical departure and innovation in mental health, and so I got to build that.
That's amazing.
And then I just created my first museum launch. So finding a way forward, especially as a woman in this industry, it's a shame. You know, Joni Mitchell should be selling as many tickets as Bob Dylan.
Right.
She was in relative obscurity until Brandy brought her back out. But Carly Simon, Ricky Lee Jones, like these heroic songwriters cannot sell the same tickets as their male counterparts. And so how do you age as a singer-songwriter in this industry? You can sit around and say sour grapes, or you can go, but what interests me?
Right.
And so for me, getting into behavioral health, getting into visual art, I pulled off an art heist. I got to do a huge art exhibit at one of the best museums in the world.
That's just happening now, right?
Yeah, I just did it. And it was so fun for me because I was so inspired, so turned on.
That's the portal, an art experience?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it pulls together visual art, which nobody knows I do, music and behavioral health in one experience where I don't have to be there and I can be a single mom.
Yeah.
And that was a completely entrepreneurial way forward that was deeply authentic to me.
And it covers everything you're interested in.
And it covers everything I mentioned in one space.
And where's that? Where is that?
That's in Crystal Bridges. It's in Bentonville, Arkansas.
I've heard of that. That's like
a great museum.
Is that the one that was, who funded that? Like the Walmart
Alice
guys?
Walton.
Yeah, right.
She founded it.
Like everyone's sort of like, this is an amazing museum in the middle of Arkansas.
And it's totally punk rock.
Yeah.
Like she bought a piece of work in New York. She's bringing it back to middle America. And the press went off on her saying, how dare you take away this masterwork where nobody can see it? And she was like, there are humans in other places besides the East and West Coast that deserve to see art. And so it's a free museum giving access and democratizing access to the best art in the world.
And how long is that show going to be up for?
It's going to be up through until the beginning of August.
That's great. And you did a record last year, a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the Picking Up the Pieces record, is that like a full circle record?
I love that record.
Yeah.
I produced that album myself. It's
But do you see it as like, it's directed to the first record, to Pieces of You, and you're sort of like full circling it?
Yeah. I didn't promote it much because I was going through like a crazy divorce at the time.
Yeah.
But for me, like, it's definitely connected to that first album. And people like that style of mine will like that album. I dare say, like, there's a song on there that I think is some of the best lyrics I've ever written. I really love it.
Which one?
It's called Love Used to Be.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Yeah.
So you're doing great.
And a crazy thing happened, too, of, like, in the early aughts, the chefs became celebrities.
Chefs.
It was never happened before.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah,
it was like
course.
All of a sudden you had these celebrity chefs
because
of,
I love them. I've interviewed Alex Guarnaccelli, Scott Conan. I got real into
chefs.
It interested me because when I looked at the economics of it, they were doing their TV shows for very little money and they were making all their money in lifestyle branding. And I was like, the digital, you know, was coming for music. And yeah. I was like, I think I'm going to start giving records away. I have to figure out how to go direct to consumer and can I build a brand around it that I could monetize. And so I had just gone into country music, but I negotiated a non-compete, non-genre album.
Yeah.
And that meant I couldn't go through any traditional distributors.
Right.
So if anybody knows about the music business, like everybody uses the same distributors, all the same labels, use these few distributors to push physical product out. So I couldn't use them. So I actually really had to like find a new path forward. And I got into the baby aisle and the greeting card aisle of Walmart and Target, where I realized my fans were shopping.
Yeah.
I outsold both my country albums. I own the full master. I own all the publishing. It's called Lullaby.
Oh.
It is still my highest earning album. Nobody even knows about it. It has been the biggest evergreen album. It's why I could take 7 years off to raise my son. It was
how do you sell when you go perform? Good?
Gosh, let's say I took 7 years off, so that puts a huge ding in your life ticket sales. You just can't come back where you left off. So
But you still have lifelong fans. Okay,
I do. Yeah. I'm really, really lucky. I toured with Train, with JD, both managed by the same manager, which was really great. I'll be touring with Melissa Etheridge this summer, which I'm really excited to do.
She's like a powerhouse. I've interviewed her too.
Yeah.
She's great. I just saw her on a plane recently with her family.
For 25 years, I've been trying to get a band to share a band. Like where we have the same band, because touring is so expensive.
Yeah.
And she's the first person in 25 years that took me up on it. And so we're splitting a band, we're splitting the crew, we're splitting like everything. And so we're both going to make, because I can't be gone for long as a mom.
Yeah.
And so I'm going to be able to be profitable in a month. Where I turned down a tour where for 4 months I just would have broke even.
And you play the hits?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't do set lists. So I'm just always people call out songs and then we'll just do what people are interested in. But this is the painting of my son.
Let me see. Wow. That's amazing.
That's what he looks like.
You painted that?
He's a really cool guy. I painted that.
Wow.
Yeah.
How come no one knows about this?
I'm just now kind of coming out about it. That's what the museum show was
about.
That's
really impressive and beautiful.
It's so fun to capture him at this age.
Yeah, he definitely seems like a character.
He is. He really is. Yeah.
Well, you sound great. It was great talking to you.
Yeah. What's the acting thing you're doing?
I'm doing a show up in Vancouver for Apple TV with Owen Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of based on golf, which I don't know much about, but it's about a couple of guys who were. It's really about Owen plays a kind of a down and out ex-pro golfer that lost his shit 20 years ago publicly and has since been kind of like making ends meet barely. And I'm his old caddy, you know, and this is 20 years after that.
Yeah.
And he sees some kid who's a prodigy and he wants to train him. And, you know, wants to take him on the road. And he kind of gets me on board and the kid's mom. Mm. And we pick up some other kid who is, you know, builds a relationship with this golf kid. And it's kind of like this make-do family, you know, out on the road in a Winnebago doing golf tournaments. Mm. And I'm kind of a, you know, cranky, but I think sweet, even a fucker. So, yeah.
And is this the part you were worried about the other night?
I'm just worried in general. I don't like being away from home a lot. And I don't even have kids.
Yeah.
I've got cats, but I get very stuck in patterns.
Yeah.
And when you, like, the idea of like having to go away for a long time. And I go on the road all the time as a comic, but to really sort of lock in and then you're like, can I still act?
Yeah.
Am I really this guy? Why do they want me? I don't know. There's other people that could do this, you know, that kind of shit.
Acting brings that shit up for me too, like more than anything else. I don't know why. It's just like.
But you're one of those people. I mean, it's like, I don't know what they're paying me for. It's to be present.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
Like, I mean, that's the thing.
Yeah.
Like, that's the magic sauce. I mean, whatever your craft is, it's really about, like, is he there in the moment? And, you know, I think I could probably pull it off.
I know you can.
Well, thank you, Jewel.
But I know what you mean. Like, when those pillars shift where you, like, have to leave, like, a foundational place.
It's the worst.
It's a hard transition psychologically.
Yeah. But usually once you get there and you're like, all right, I've got my, you know, I got my coffee maker.
Yeah. You settle back in.
Right,
you got your new routine.
Right. And it'll be all right.
Yeah.
Great talking.
Right on.
There you go. Pretty amazing. What a, like, she does so much.
You can get all the information about the Portal exhibit and the LP, plus her tour with Melissa Etheridge and Jewel's charitable foundations at jeweljk.com. Hang out for a minute, folks. So, folks, as I mentioned, Jewel is going out on tour with Melissa Etheridge this summer. Back in 2014, I talked to Melissa Etheridge, and she performed her song, Take My Number, which is still one of the best live performances we've ever had in the garage.
And you don't know what might be waiting for you tonight. Oh, you really shouldn't drive. You had too much to drink, and you shouldn't be alone. Where all you're gonna do is think. You should take my number, or I can take you home, yeah. We can find a cup of coffee, we can sit all night and talk. But there's a diner always open, just around the block. So take my number, or I can take you home. Take you home.
That's from episode 561 with Melissa Etheridge, and it's available for free on all podcast platforms. If you want every episode of WTF ad-free and bonus content like our live music mixtapes, which have all the live performances from the garage, sign up for WTF Plus. Just go to the link in the episode description or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast, and here's a selection of a riff from the vault.
Monkey, LaFonda.
Got angels everywhere, man.